Hello and welcome to the sewers of Paris. You might have seen the news this week that after 3 decades, NBC canceled the entertainment show E! News. For this week's episode, we're revisiting my 2015 conversation with one of the hosts of E! News, Steve Kometko. Steve was the face of E! From 1994 to 2002, and in addition to hosting the news show, he also anchored countless Emmy and Oscar broadcasts, reported from film festivals, and interviewed everyone who was anyone in Hollywood. It was his dream job, but privately, he was being weighed down by a lifetime of baggage, a career that demanded that he stay closeted, and a religious upbringing that burdened him with guilt. We'll have that conversation in just a minute. First, a reminder that The Sewers of Paris is on Twitter and Facebook, where I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode. This week, I'll be posting clips from Peter Pan with Mary Martin, Whoopi Goldberg in Ghost, and of course, Steve himself reporting on entertainment. And I hope you'll join me for our next fun-friendly live stream on August 15th at 11 a.m. Pacific. It's a nice, relaxing time to hang out and chat. There's a link at the top of the Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. And don't forget to check out my other shows. Culture Cruise on YouTube is a deep dive into queer entertainment milestones. And check out Queens of Adventure and Queens of Adventure Legends, two narrative comedy podcasts with drag heroes going on adventures in a world of fantasy. Now, here's my 2015 interview with Steve Kometko. Hello and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. I'm joined today by Steve Kometko. Steve, thank you so much for chatting with me.
I love Paris. I'm happy to be here, Matt.
Wonderful. I'm glad we could bring you over. So tell me, what's the entertainment that changed your life?
A number of things, a combination of things. I fell in love with theater when my brother took me at age 12 to see the production of Oliver, because I was about the same age as Oliver in the play, and I liked the songs he sang, and I fancied myself a singer. And then when I saw movies, I mean, anything that would take me away, this has been said by so many people ad infinitum, anything that would take me out of reality. I wasn't a fan as a youngster, or even today, of hanging around in reality. I'm just not very good at it. So I would lose myself in movies or in television. I can remember as a kid watching Peter Pan with Mary Martin on television, even though it was just black and white and you could see the strings flying her across the stage.
I'm flying. Look at me, way up high, suddenly, here am I, I'm flying.
The reality that you were kind of getting away from, what sort of environment were you growing up in?
It was kind of a harsh, you know, on one hand I can recognize it and view it as being a positive environment, but on the other hand, there were parts of it that just were a little too harsh for me as a kid. My father was a Baptist minister, evangelical, very strict, no drinking, smoking, dancing, playing cards, going to movies. When I was young, all those things were forbidden. And since he was always busy with the church, mom kind of took over with the firm hand. Spare the rod and spoil the child. That's what they kind of believed in. And I was the youngest of 5 kids, and I always felt as though I wasn't big enough, I wasn't good enough, I wasn't funny enough or smart enough. My brothers and sisters always had it up, you know, always had a leg up on me. And I felt pretty inferior. I don't know if this is true for most people, but that's where I come at it from. I just, it was very difficult. I had a very difficult time coping. And then, I found my refuge in entertainment. It's not been always a very easy life for me. I had another sister, who passed away. She came to visit me in California. And I went to work one day and came home and found she had gone into the swimming pool on her own and had an asthma attack and drowned. And that was quite a shock to my system when I came home from work. And then I just lost my last sister a year ago December from cancer. So there were 5 of us. My brother was the oldest, I was the youngest, and now there's just 2 of us left. My mother is still alive. She's 96 years old. And I came back to Chicago about 8 years ago to try and help them out. My parents were, you know, getting up there in years, and As it turns out, my father died within just a couple of months of my coming home. So for a person who was a little on the sensitive side, they were difficult experiences to have, even as an adult. So, you know, like so many people, I found my refuge in entertainment. I've heard Carol Burnett, for example, say, you know, how she was an usher at the local theater, and that's where she would lose herself because her mother was an alcoholic, I believe, and she was brought up by her grandmother, and her father left the family and deserted the family. He was an alcoholic as well. And so, you know, you just, when things happen, you just have to find a way to cope, and my way of coping was entertainment.
So tell me, as a kid, what were some of those worlds that you would escape into?
Oh, well, one of my favorite movies, it remains my favorite movie, is The Wizard of Oz, because it was, you know, all fantasy. And I'm one of those, as a gay man, I guess it's my lot in life, but I found Judy Garland to be just one of the greatest talents that walked the face of the earth. You know, the other thing that I tried to escape from was being gay in a Baptist church. It just wasn't happening for a young gay man.
Sure. How old were you when you realized that you were gay?
Oh, God. Very young. I would say I realized it at age maybe 6. I was born in Cleveland, Ohio. My family moved to Chicago when I was 6. And, you know, before that, I had had experiences with the little boy next door. But, you know, I didn't have a label for it or a name for it at that time. The two of us knew we were having some fun. But I went so far as when I was so concerned about it. I mean, I got married to a woman at age 23, even though I knew in my heart of hearts that I was gay. And that was a very difficult situation, too, because it hurt her and her family. It's just, you know, there were certain things, I'm sure you understand, I don't think you're old enough to have experienced it, but there's certain things that just were not discussed. It was just a tough time back then. I lost a job in Michigan when the general manager of the station I was working at learned that I was gay.
Did you try to straighten yourself when you were younger? Did you try to become straight?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. When I first went into television and started recording things in college, I heard my voice and I thought, my God, I sound like a flaming queer. And I tried so desperately to change the way I spoke, to lower my voice, to speak with some authority, all because I didn't want to be found out. But
was there a point when you said that you had those early experiences and you knew from an early age that you were gay? Was there a time when you did get the label, when you were like, oh, that's what I am, and it's a bad thing?
Yes, yeah. My nickname in high school or in elementary school, my nickname was Femme. That's what the tough guys would call me. Hey, Femme.
Was it hard for you to access entertainment when you were young? Because I know your media consumption must have been pretty highly regulated.
Yes, it was. When I wanted to go see a movie like The Beatles' Help, I remember sneaking with friends on a Saturday, taking the bus, and having enough money. You know, back then, I think it was 50 cents to get into the theater and 12 cents to ride the bus. I could manage to come up with that much money. Or I would just hitch a ride. You know, I had a lot of friends whose parents didn't mind if they went to movies, and I would just hitch along.
Do you remember some of the early movies that you saw?
Absent-Minded Professor with Jerry Lewis, I saw that. Ben-Hur, I saw. The Ten Commandments, those were okay because they were considered, you know, religious. And my parents didn't have a problem with those.
Let my people go!
The slaves are mine. Their lives are mine. All that they own is mine. I do not know your God, nor will I let Israel go.
Who are you to make their lives bitter in hard bondage? Man shall be ruled by law, not by the will of other men.
What a force. Who is this god that I should let your people go?
Aaron, pass down my staff before Pharaoh, that he may see the power of God.
You mentioned that The Wizard of Oz was one of the ones that really stuck with you.
Yeah.
What was it? Did you have a favorite character or a favorite moment?
Please, I used to wear a t-shirt that said, "I'm a friend of Dorothy's." Mm-hmm. I wore that t-shirt to the 1993 March on Washington. And I remember we got onto a subway to go to the parade route. I was with about eight other people. And there were some young students on that subway who were making their way downtown as well. And they were, I would say, elementary school age. And they read my t-shirt and said, "What does that mean? I'm a friend of Dorothy's." I don't remember how I explained it to them, but I think I did turn red. There were so many memorable characters and memorable lines, and the art direction, the tornado that swept Dorothy away.
Did you have a feeling that that's something that you wanted to get, you know, pulled away from the life that you were in and put someplace magical?
Well, yeah, I could draw that comparison. After all, that's what Dorothy was looking for. You suppose there is such a place, Toto? It's not a place you can get to by a boat or a train. It's far, far away. I can recite that movie beginning to end pretty accurately, I think.
Wow, so you're really a real devotee.
Yes, yes. I met one of the Munchkins when they celebrated the 50th anniversary of The Wizard of Oz in 1989. Got an autograph, got a picture with him. Meinhard Robbie was his name. He was the coroner. You know, as coroner, I must aver, I thoroughly examined her, and she's not only really dead, she's really most sincerely dead. Yes, I got to talk to him, which was a real kick. A lot of people say, don't you get nervous when you interview some of these people, some of these stars? Aren't you tongue-tied? And, you know, I never really was. Except on a couple of occasions. I'm a big sports nut, believe it or not, and one of the people who got me tongue-tied was Michael Jordan, because being from Chicago and what he did with the Chicago Bulls, I really went nuts meeting him. Talking to Liza Minnelli, interviewing Barbara Streisand, who could not have been nicer to me. Afterwards, she sent me a handwritten note saying, "Thanks very much for your kind words about Prince of Tides." A friend of mine made me a copy of all the reports, and thanks very much for your kind words. So, you know, Betty Davis, meeting Betty Davis was pretty incredible. And she's the source of one of my favorite stories. When I talked to her about being in Whales of August with Lillian Gish.
When we were children, you believed that the whales changed the seasons.
I did?
Yes. Father told you that the whales caught the wind with their tails and brought it down from the Arctic.
And I believed him?
Yes, you did.
I said, "What is it like working with Lillian Gish?" But together, the two of you cover so much of cinematic history, your life span cinematic history. And she said, "Miss Gish never should have left Silent Pictures," which just cracked me up. She was a pistol, Betty Davis was.
That's fantastic.
You know, this is going to sound odd, but in some way I knew somewhere in the back of my mind that I would wind up in Hollywood doing something connected with the entertainment industry. I can't say exactly why I knew that, but I just had, I always had an inkling. I always had a feeling like something like that would happen. And it did. I think, you know, we're capable of creating our own destiny.
Growing up, I know that your faith must have been a pretty important part of your life. Did you ever feel like the faith and your interest in entertainment were in conflict with each other?
It was always a conflict. You know, as we get older, I think we develop our own ideas of what our beliefs are. And I had some real conflicts in my mind about what I was doing and the way I was raised. And it was difficult. It was difficult. There were times when it was really difficult.
Did you have to eventually just make a clean break and say, I have to choose one or the other?
Well, let's say I've been through a lot of therapy. and I work very hard at feeling as though my belief system is as legitimate as my parents thought the one they were giving me was. Mm. You have to, at some point, grab onto that which gives you gratification. I mean, I think every gay person at some point comes to realize that it's not a choice. It's absolutely not a choice. And so whatever guilt, which is a waste of time, whatever guilt you may have connected with being gay, you have to lose it. And shame, oof. I lived a shame-based life for a long time. So many times I remember my mother saying to me, you know, shame on you. Or my sister saying that to me. Once when I went to Berlin for one of the Berlin film festivals, and while I was there, I celebrated a birthday. And I was there by myself. I didn't have any traveling companions or anything. So on a whim, I decided to get my ear pierced. And I went to this mall that near where I was staying. And the woman said, she started to pierce my right ear. And I said, I want the left ear. I want this ear pierced. And she said, that is the ear that the homosexuals wear their earrings in. And I said, well, I'm gay. And she said, oh, well, then it's okay.
And, wow.
Yes. And then I remember telling my mother, because she was going to see it anyway if she turned into television and watched me on the air. And so I just mentioned it to her. You know, I said, I wanted to shake myself up. And she said, well, what you've done is brought shame to the entire family just by getting my ear pierced.
Boy, oh boy.
So, you know, it was there were times that were very difficult. And I had a partner for 17 years. My parents would always behave with Kirk as though he was giving up his bedroom for them to sleep in. Kirk and I always shared the same bed and the same bedroom when they came to visit. But at the end of every visit, Mom and Dad would go out to the car and they would say to Kirk, thanks for letting us use your bedroom. It was like, okay, they just don't want to see it or don't want to believe it. So, you know, it's denial.
Did you just need to get out of there as quickly as you could once you were done with high school?
No, because then I was, you know, I thought I was doing the right thing. My older brother, who is also gay, I can remember my parents being very disappointed that he never got married. And so I was going to do right by them by getting married to my childhood sweetheart. So that's what I did. And then when I finally did get a job in television and we moved away, that's when I got extremely lonely because I had no one to talk to about it. I felt like I was living a lie. I was hurting her. And there's just certain things that we all have to endure.
How long were you together?
Well, we had dated for quite a while in high school. Through high school and into college, but as far as I, you know, it's almost as though the second my father said, "I now pronounce you man and wife," it's like I knew almost immediately that I had made a big mistake. And she was a wonderful person, and I take all responsibility and blame. But you know, I thought I was doing the right thing.
So you mentioned that. You moved away with her when you got your first job in broadcasting. Where was that?
I actually dropped out of college to take a job in Rhinelander, Wisconsin, in the late 70s. When a job came along, you took it. You didn't have the option because they were so few and far between. There were no cable systems or satellite dishes or syndicated programming. There was just...
You know, in the major markets, there were just usually three large stations, ABC, CBS, NBC. And occasionally in places like Chicago and New York, there were large independents like WGN or WOR. So jobs were few and far between. So when this job came along, we happened to be visiting a family of hers who lived in northern Wisconsin. And they said, why don't you stop at the local TV station? They'll hire anybody. And sure enough, they did.
Were you searching for an opportunity to do something like that?
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's my major in college was broadcast communications. And so I stopped at this station as we were leaving town. It was WAEO, Channel 12 in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. And they sat me down in front of a camera, gave me some copy off a teletype machine, and said, read. And so I did. And when I was done, the general manager said, come back in a week. You got a job. And so I was just floored. And that first job paid me $125 a week. I came back in a week. And I was there for about 10 months. And then when I felt I'd had enough experience, I drove down to Green Bay, Wisconsin, took a tape with me, and stopped at all the stations there, the three stations there. And one of them said, come on back in 2 weeks. And so I did. And so that began my modus operandi for the next 5 years. I went from Rhinelander, Wisconsin, to Green Bay, Wisconsin, to Grand Rapids, Michigan, to Louisville, Kentucky, to Los Angeles, all in 5 years. I made a lot of moves. And and I just, you know, somehow or another, I just knew that I would, like I said earlier, wind up in the entertainment industry in some way, shape, or form. And I did. And
was it important to you to remain closeted during that time? Did people find out that you were gay?
I was very closeted. Completely different time then, Matt. You know, when I was in Grand Rapids, Michigan, I was about to get a promotion, and someone decided they would share with the general manager that I was gay. And so he called me up to his office and sat me down and talked to me for a long time. And then at the end of the discussion, where he asked me all kinds of questions, like, did I show affection to my partner in public? Did my parents know? You know, things he had absolutely no right to ask. But at the end of this probing interrogation, he said, well, you might as well start looking for a job somewhere else because you're not going any further here. And I was just, I was really devastated because I always wanted to be in television, on television. And then the next job I got was in Louisville, Kentucky. And I thought, oh, God, the South, what are they going to do to me? But as it turns out, Louisville was a wonderful place to work. And just about everybody there knew I was gay, and it was not an issue. It was more of an issue when I got to Los Angeles than it was in Louisville, Kentucky.
Oh, really? Why was that?
Well, back in the early 80s, CBS was a very conservative network, and there were no such things as gay people. When my news director found out, when someone decided to tell him, he said, you're not going to go marching in any parades or anything, are you? He said, we don't mind that you're gay, but, you know, just kind of keep it under your hat. All right, you know, if I have to, I have to. And then right after that, in the same conversation, he said, say, my partner at the time worked in retail at a very nice furniture store in Los Angeles. And he said, hey, if I send my wife in to see Kirk, would he be able to show her around and give her, you know, a deal? It's like, wait a second, you slap me with one hand and then put out your other hand for a gratuity. What is this about?
Wow. So as you're working your way from station to station, were you getting closer to doing more of the entertainment reporting that you wanted to be doing?
Yes. When I went to Los Angeles, of course, I realized that the opportunity might present itself, and I lobbied for it. And it took me maybe 4 or 5 years in Los Angeles before they gave me a shot at it. But the funny thing is, they gave me a shot at it when I got a call from Entertainment Tonight saying, come on over here, we'd like to talk to you. And when I got a, a, hosted a syndicated show called the Rock and Roll Evening News.
From around the world and across the nation,
it's the Rock and Roll Evening News.
Anchor Steve Kometko hosts your backstage pass to the people, events, and music that move an entire generation.
Have you heard the news?
And all of a sudden, when other people start seeing you in a certain light, then the people who have you under contract look at you in a whole new way. And that's how it worked for me. They saw that other people recognized some kind of a ability that I had of covering entertainment. It's just something that came naturally to me. You don't want to play against me in Trivial Pursuit Silver Screen Edition. So, you know, it just it worked out well for me.
So what are some of the opportunities you had, you know, when you were there at CBS? Did you start meeting the celebrities and the entertainers that informed your childhood?
Not right off the bat, but, you know, I remember one year, I was the nightside reporter, and the producer of the 11 o'clock news came up to me and said, "Hey, you want to go cover the Oscars?" I said, "Sure."
She said, "Okay. What kind of question is that?"
Yeah. "Go down and get a tuxedo at the Tuxedo Center down the street." And that was quite a thrill. I think the first one I covered was the movie that won Best Picture was Amadeus. They saw that I could do it and that I didn't have to be schooled on what questions to ask and that I had some kind of working knowledge of movies and entertainment. And it stuck. And then I covered it every year after that. And then, you know, when CBS decided that an entertainment reporter was a mediocre commodity, as the Wizard says in The Wizard of Oz, why, that's a very mediocre commodity. They let me go, and E! Had been after me for some time. And we hooked up, and I was there for another 8.5 years. And that was a really terrific experience for me. Best job I ever had. And it's there that I got to meet, you name it. And when you have people like Robin Williams or Julia Roberts requesting that you do the interview with them, you know, or I remember once for the movie Postcards from the Edge, early in the morning, publicist for Meryl Streep came up to me and said, "Steve, you always do such a good job, and Meryl hates doing these press junkets. Would you mind going first?" And I said, "Not at all. I'd be happy to." And it was, you know, I had a lot of great experiences.
Who were some of the memorable folks that you talked to who really stuck with you?
Well, let's see. I'm sitting in my office right now, and there's a picture of me with Sharon Stone, Gene Hackman, Kevin Costner, Julia Roberts, Bruce Valanche, Clint Eastwood, Shirley MacLaine.
I want to imagine that they're all in the same photograph. Like, for some reason, all of these people were in the same room at the same time.
Yeah, right. It was the first of the big selfies. No. You know, Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau and, you know, a lot of people who are no longer with us. Elizabeth Taylor. And she was stunning. She was one of those. I remember at one of the big events at the Beverly Hilton Hotel, her date on that night was the very tan George Hamilton. And the two of them came around the corner together, and it was just one of those things where you gasp. You just, you know, the first time you see. I wasn't tongue-tied or anything, but I was just, wow. Another time that happened was with Audrey Hepburn. Wow. You know, and Gregory Peck. It's just, these are people. Sophia Loren, oh my God. She just had a certain stature, a certain attitude. And it wasn't haughty or anything like that. But when she walked into a room, you sat up and took notice. The same with Cher. Cher was a real pistol. But boy, could she give a good interview. I remember the first time I interviewed her, I said, "You know what? You're not at all what I expected." And she said, "Well, what did you expect?" I said, "Oh, I don't know, kind of a little more tart." And she said, "Well, try messing with She said, try fucking with me and see what I turn into. But sitting down with these people was a great thrill.
Did you have sort of a wish list, like people who were particularly important for you to have an opportunity to talk to?
No, but I remember after I interviewed Barbara Streisand, I said to my producer, you know, I can die and go to gay heaven. I've interviewed Bette Midler, Liza Minnelli, Cher, Barbara Streisand, Betty Davis. They're gonna wave me right in.
Yeah, you've got good recommendations, good credentials.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Let him in. Oh, it's Steve.
Did you have? I love the story about Cher saying "Don't fuck with me." Did you have other surprises or just memorable moments with some of these interviews?
Well, there was there was another instance with Cher, and she knew. You know, the interesting thing about Cher is she always knew what she was saying. I made the mistake, or maybe I did it intentionally, to ask her what her opinion was of Madonna. This is when Madonna was still, you know, relatively new on the scene. And I said, you know, there seems to be a lot of similarities to my way of thinking. You know, you're a fashion icon, as is she. You're a trailblazer, as she is today. And I said, you know, what's your opinion of Madonna? And she said, you know, I've met Madonna. I'm friends with Sean Penn. And I was invited to their home, and I went to their wedding. And she said, I met Madonna, and it just seems to me that she could be a little bit more magnanimous and a little bit less of a cunt, right on camera. I was caught speechless. I didn't know quite what to say. But she knew exactly what she was saying, and it wound up on the headlines of the newspapers in Great Britain. And then she would remind me every time we did an interview after that, oh, you, Kometko, you got me into so much trouble. I didn't get her into trouble. She did it all on her own. So that was fun. And then the story I think I told you the other day about Susan Sarandon, when she asked me how I liked the movie Stepmother or Stepmom. And I said, you know, I had to leave early before they turned the lights up so people wouldn't see me crying. And she said, oh, God, let a woman see you cry. And they love that. They'll be lined up around the block if they see you have a sensitive side. I said, yeah, but I'm gay. And she said, oh, well, they like that even better. So, you know, I had some. Whoopi Goldberg was always a wonderful interview for me. You know, when you go in and do these junket interviews, and it's one interview after another, we got to a point where I was getting the wrap-up signal. And I said, I'm sorry, Whoopi, I'm getting the wrap-up. I gotta go. And then she turned around and looked into the camera and said, he gets as long as he wants. Go ahead, Steve. Ask your next question. She was just, she was terrific. Plus, you know what helped me a lot, Matt? There's a lot of gay people working in Hollywood. And Whoopi had a wonderful assistant who passed away, sadly, of AIDS. But he's the one who said to her, you need to do an interview with this guy. And it was the year she won the Oscar for Ghost.
Molly, you're in danger.
Now, you can't just blurt it out like that and quit moving around, will you? Because you're starting to make me dizzy. I'll just tell her in my own way. Molly, you in danger, girl.
And she invited me to her home for a party, for a birthday party. It was just... And Cher's publicist at that time, Billy Samuth, also, you know, he said to Cher when the interview was done, didn't I tell you he was good? You know, it was when I finally got to Hollywood and had, you know, built a little bit of a reputation, that's when finally being gay wasn't a setback or a shortcoming.
Sounds like you're in the world where you were born to live in the role you were born to play.
Well, that's what I like to say. It's a little pompous, but if you can't be pompous by the time you're 62, you can't be pompous.
I wanted to get to the decision to finally come out. How did that happen?
I had been living a lie for so long. Well, I hate to say living a lie. That sounds so so negative. And my shrink is trying to get me to be more positive. It just, as time went on, it got more and more prevalent. I mean, I remember the movie. The first time I went to E!, there were two people in the newsroom having a conversation over, you know, like from a desk at one side of the room to a desk at the other side of the room. And what they were discussing was why Tom Hanks and Antonio Banderas Jr. didn't have more kisses, on-screen kisses, in Philadelphia. And that was really an awakening for me, because that kind of thing just wasn't discussed at CBS when I was there. And so all of a sudden to have this so openly discussed said to me, you know, gee, I may not have to hide here. So that was a contributing factor. And then, you know, it just became more and more accepted, even though I had a manager and an agent who both said, you can't do this. And the Advocate had been after me for a long time to do a cover story.
Why did the manager and agent not want you to do it? What was the fear?
They were both gay, and it was the old, it'll ruin your career. And the fact of the matter is, I think if you talk to anybody now who is gay, I mean, ask Anderson Cooper, ask Ellen DeGeneres, did coming out ruin your career? If anything, it enhanced their careers. So, you know, that was just part of the standard operating procedure in Hollywood. It's no secret, there was a period of time when I was dating Greg Louganis, and Greg was so well known and was so, you know, had come out when he talked about having HIV, and he used to joke that he had become a professional gay, because when anybody wanted a quote on something, they'd call Greg. And so, you know, it started appearing in tabloids that I was seeing Greg. It was in, I have two Inquirers, Page Six from the New York Post. Greg traveled with me. He was, you know, not working per se. And so he would sometimes come with me when I went to film festivals. And so there's always a lot of reporters at those things. And it just, you know, I just got tired. I think that happens to people who've been closeted for a while. I just got tired. I sometimes wish I had been open, or myself, earlier in my life, because there was someone in my life who I was with for 17 years. And had I been able to be myself more, and I have no one to blame but me for not being me, you know, I might still be with that person. No, because I still love that person very much, but it's not to be. And now, you know, it's just not that easy coming back to a city where you didn't work and meeting people. I'm going to sound like a real sad sack here, but it's not, you know, I'm not. It's not easy for me to meet people. I just don't know how to do it that well. It's funny, I could operate in a professional capacity at CBS and at E. I had a job to do, and there was a role I had to play. But, you know, sometimes being myself is difficult. You know, if that makes any sense whatsoever.
Sure, sure. No, I know the feeling exactly. You know, I photograph a lot of parties, and so it's so easy for me to walk into a party with a camera and just start taking pictures of strangers. But if I walk into a party without a camera, you know, my first order of business is figuring out where the snacks are so I can hide behind them for the rest of the night.
Yep. That's, you know, that's another reason. I used to say, I don't know if I was kidding myself or what, but I used to say I like to... When I go home, it's my refuge, and I don't like to talk about it because that's where I live and lead my life and stuff. In retrospect, that probably wasn't the healthiest way of living my life.
Well, no, I know that it's so important to have that sort of refuge, especially like when your professional life is so much about openness and getting people to tell a story, and you know, it's all about communication and reflection and remembering things. I mean, you've got to have a place of solitude away from that.
Yeah.
So it must have been awfully stressful to think about being open to a degree you never had been before with The Advocate.
Yes. And I got to know Judy Weider, who conducted the interview, and I liked her a great deal, and I thought she did an excellent job. In fact, not terribly long ago. I still have people who contact me, and for a while I was trying to maintain a Steve Kometko Facebook page, but I just don't have the impetus any longer. I don't have the drive to do that. But I posted that article, maybe a few years ago, and I got so much feedback from it. A lot of it from people I went to elementary and high school with, saying, you know, we didn't know this, and, you know, talking about being called femme or fag growing up. It's they, you know, didn't realize that. So that was kind of nice to hear from those people. It was very nice. It was very nice.
When the article actually appeared, what kind of feedback did you get at the time?
It was all positive. You know, there were. I take that back. It wasn't all positive, because there were some people who would send me anonymous emails or call me, mostly because of I was dating Greg and he was HIV positive. I had people say, you know, do you have some kind of a death wish, which is just ridiculous. In fact, one of the things I'm most proud of in my career was back in... when AIDS Project Los Angeles first opened up, it was across the street. It was in a little bungalow across the street from Gold's Gym on Cole Street in Hollywood. I don't even think the building exists anymore that they were in. And when I was a reporter for CBS, there were a lot of people who wouldn't cover the AIDS epidemic. And I remember there was a fellow who was running it at the time, Bill Meisenheimer. And my crew would not go into the building. And I had to go in and get him. And I remember him thanking me and saying, you know, this is terrific and thanks for doing this. And he was totally understanding about coming outside. But, you know, I'm glad I was able to do that. And I used to volunteer on election nights to cover any issues that might be detrimental to the gay community. Without ever really saying, but I would, you know, about myself, but I would talk to the producers who knew I was gay. Just about everybody off air that I worked with knew. So, you know, you just get tired of playing the game, especially since my dad was alive and a minister and mom. I just that was rough.
Yeah, how did they react to? Was that when they found out that you were gay, or did you come out to them separately?
It has never been discussed, and, you know, Dad's gone now, and Mom's 96, and I don't try to push it on her at this age, but I don't hide it either. I don't, you know, I don't go hiding stuff in my home when she comes over, and as I mentioned last time, when she used to visit my my ex and I, they always used to, you know, we slept in the same room, we traveled with my parents. It's not like we ever tried to hide anything. We just weren't. It wasn't discussed, and I figured, okay, they don't want to talk. And I'm certain they knew. I'm certain they knew, but I think they were in denial and they didn't want to think about it.
Did you feel once the article came out, did it feel like there was a weight lifted, or did you feel like your life was about to change?
I suppose it changed a little bit. I tried not to think about it. It gave me play Boys in the Band, they would talk about having an ick attack. And every once in a while I'd have an ick attack if I thought somebody was looking at me funny or was talking about me or whatever. Or I would say what we used to call the gay man's prayer. Dear God, please don't let my wrist go limp today. So, you know, fortunately for the most part, I think I have a pretty healthy sense of humor, and I'm usually able to see the funny side of things. Not always. And the further away it gets in time, the more revisionist history I conduct.
Whenever. Did you find that anyone treated you differently after it happened?
In the gay community, I got a lot of positive feedback in the form of emails and voicemails and things of that nature. As much as I talk about hiding it and being closeted, I did try to do what I could. You know, I participated in the AIDS ride. I did the closing ceremonies one year in West Hollywood when all the bikers came in. I participated in reading names from the quilt when they displayed it at the Pacific Design Center, and they had people come in and read names. You know, I tried to be, to the degree that I thought I could do it safely, I tried to be a presence. And then finally it just got to a point where it wasn't an issue anymore.
Did you find that coming out changed the way that you thought of yourself?
I suppose it's okay to say that in some ways I was proud of myself. And you know what? Because celebrities are always, or very often, the object of personal questions, sometimes I felt as though they were more open with me and able to talk to me. You know, if you sometimes, a lot of times, if you share a secret about yourself with someone else, they in turn share with you. So there were some celebrities who I just thought were terrific, you know, terrific with me. There was an article, People Magazine did an article with me too. And shortly thereafter, where it talked about Greg and I going together, I had gone to France to cover the Deauville Film Festival. And George Clooney was there with his girlfriend. And I'd known George peripherally because we both worked out at the Hollywood YMCA. And we had talked there because his father was an anchorman at Channel 4. And so we talked, and he's very, very in tune with all kinds of news, events of the day and issues. So we were at I was at the Deauville Film Festival, and George walked by, and I said, "Hey, George, can you stop and do an interview?" And he said, I can't. I have to do a live thing for France TV4 right now, but come inside, and when I'm done, I'll come over and talk with you. I said, "Oh, great, thanks." So we set up, and then George came over, and I asked, I forget who he was seeing at the time, who can keep track, but you know, I remarked that his date was very attractive, and he said, "Yeah, she said the same thing about you, and I don't like it." And I said, "Oh, come on. Don't you read People magazine? You have nothing to worry about." He said, "Yeah, I read People. I'm just giving you shit." So, you know, he was just funning with me. It wasn't an issue for him. It was his way of saying that. So I think in some ways people opened up more, celebrities. I tell you, Matt, I had the best job there was, and I really miss it.
When did you step back?
When E let me go, I had a number of interviews at that time with different outlets, and one of the things I kept hearing back was that I was too closely identified with E, that people kind of looked at me as the face of E at that time. And we really did expand a great deal. When I started at E, we were in 30 million homes. And when I left, we were in, I believe, 85 million and 125 countries. So I was there during the formative years, and it doesn't make much sense to me, but that's what I had been told several times, that I was just too closely identified with a product. And at that time, I was laid off. I wasn't working regularly. I did some freelance work for Fox, Channel 11, in Los Angeles, because some of my CBS cronies worked there, and I could get a job. But, you know, quite frankly, I was going out on breaking news stories, house fires, murders, things of that nature, and that I just couldn't do that anymore. It just didn't hold any attraction for me. And so, you know, and I couldn't find work in the entertainment field. And as I mentioned, I think before, my parents were getting older, and I always thought I wanted to come back to Chicago. And so that's why I did. And Disney did bring me out 5 years ago in 2010 to host an hour-long special for them. But other than that, there hasn't been too much interest. And now that I'm, 13 years away from E, almost a whole new generation that doesn't know who I am. So it's been a long time since I've had a television agent. You know, I may have mentioned the last one I had told me that I had passed my sell-by date. And so I kind of threw up my hands and said, "Well, that was that. I had a great career, and I really enjoyed myself. Now let's do something else.
Looking back at you know, young Steve, who's, you know, obsessing over the stars and the musicals and feeling this pressure to stay in, how do you think the young you would look back on being out and talking to these people and being open and honest and having that life?
Well, I think if I had had a crystal ball at the time and a genie told me that I was going to be talking to these stars and working in Hollywood, I mentioned the other day that somewhere in the back of my mind, I just felt that that was going to become a reality at some point. But at the same time, I think I would have said, I can't believe that that's going to happen. I just can't believe it. I'll tell you what's great. I was sitting at Kate Mantellini, the late lamented Kate Mantellini's, one night with friends having dinner, and Sharon Stone came in, and she spotted me sitting at a table, and she came over, and I stood up, and she threw her arms around me, gave me a big kiss, and said, "How are you doing?" And I said, "Fine, nice to see you." And she, you know, went to her table. But when you sit back down and you see the expressions on the other people's faces at the table, it's kind of, oh, yeah, that was Sharon Stone. You know, it's just one of those hard to describe experiences without sounding, you know, like you're the greatest thing since sliced bread. I'm not. But I had a great time and I really loved those experiences.
And it sounds like they really appreciated you, like that they were asking for you, and you know that you knew the questions to ask and you knew how to be a decent person to them.
Well, you know, I would, if there was a sensitive topic to discuss, I tried to couch it in such a way that, you know, I could ask it without being embarrassed myself.
Sure. And, you know, I'm sure that being through that process of being closeted and knowing what it is to have that sort of unspoken boundary in a conversation, like it gives you a certain sympathy that most other interviewers just wouldn't understand.
Maybe so. I'll take your word for it.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for joining me.
It's been fun, Matt. I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening, and thanks to Steve for joining me. For my recommendation this week, check out two Steve Kometko interviews, one where he's asking the questions and one where he's answering them. Steve's coming out interview in The Advocate is a fascinating time capsule, chock full of what were then timely references to Matthew Shepard, Ellen DeGeneres, and a vastly different cultural climate. It was a tough time for anyone to be so publicly out, but Steve has a surprising comment halfway through the interview. He marvels at how much easier it is to be out in 1999 than it was just a few years before. Just as I was thinking to myself as I was reading it, how much easier it is to be out today in 2020. The second interview is a marvelous little video from 1987, available on YouTube, in which Steve asks Bette Davis to reflect back on her career. The entire thing is captivating, from 79-year-old Betty's cutting remarks about the industry to the cigarette smoldering in her hand throughout the conversation. It's a fantastic spotlight, not just on the actress, but on Steve's warm demeanor and his attention to his guests. Thanks again for listening, and thanks to everyone who makes The Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to support the show and get backer rewards. I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode on Twitter and Facebook. Reach out and let me know your thoughts on the show at sewerspodcast@gmail.com. And join us for the next Sewers of Paris live stream on August 15th at 11 a.m. Pacific. There's a link pinned to the top of the Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. Check out my YouTube series Culture Cruise for detailed explorations of queer milestones from TV and film. And subscribe to my podcasts, Queens of Adventure and Queens of Adventure Legends, two comedy adventure shows featuring drag heroes in a world of fantasy. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod and Comptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.